Greetings to Coma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. Today we're going to be talking with Ingrid Archibald. She's an activist with Safe Cities. She's got her finger on the pulse of a lot of stuff that's going on down here in Tacoma, especially around the tide flats and especially around fossil fuel and all of the environmental implications of that product. So I'm sure that you're going to be impressed with her passion for her subject. Let's listen in and see what's up with Ingrid Archibald. So really happy to be welcoming Ingrid Archibald to Climate Talk today. Welcome, Ingrid.
Thanks, John.
So you are with an organization, at least I guess it's an organization called Safe Cities. So tell us about what is Safe Cities?
Yeah, so Safe Cities is a global movement. It's all of the communities and organizers and even people in elected positions who are working to end the expansion of fossil fuels. I actually work for an organization called Stand.Earth, and SAFE is one of our programs that we work on. So it's not a standalone organization by itself. It's part of the work that we do with Stand.
Gotcha. So let's talk about the larger organization then for just a second. So what is Stand.Earth? And that's the way you say it? You say Stand.Earth? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You say Stand.Earth.
Okay. So what is Stand.Earth? What's that all about?
So Stand is a nonprofit advocacy organization, and our mission is to build people power to hold corporations and governments accountable to putting people in the environment first. So it used to be called forest ethics, and our history is really rooted in ending deforestation. So that's why it was called forest ethics. But then as our mission expanded and we started to work on climate justice issues and fossil fuels, the folks at the organization realized that forest ethics didn't really describe their mission anymore, and decided to make it more general about environment and climate issues. So a lot of the work at Stand is rooted in holding corporations accountable and pressuring companies to, improve their practices so that they're taking better care of the environment, reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, standing up for human rights, workers' rights. But the work that I do with Safe Cities is more about passing local policy. So it's pretty divorced from corporate campaigning. But a lot of my colleagues work on corporate campaigns.
Got it. Understood. So you mentioned, I believe you said Stand.Earth is a nonprofit. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So where does the money come from? Just doing full disclosure here.
Yeah. So our money comes from grants and foundations, and then, from individual donors. So folks, chipping in like $5 a month, or, major donors who are, maybe wealthier and have the ability to give more money. But we don't take any corporate money or any governmental funds.
Yeah. And that'd be a good thing. So, but I will have show notes for this, so we can put a link in the show notes. So folks who do want to support the work you do, which sounds really valuable and important work, so that they can do that. So what are Safe Cities? It's you work primarily with local government entities, the way I think that's what I heard you say. Is that right?
Yeah. So okay. we work to create partnerships with local electeds who are excited about achieving climate justice in their communities and who want to pass safe policies. But really, we want to uplift and support the organizers and the community members in that community who are organizing and building power to pass safe policies. So we work both, in the community with folks, and then also bridging the gap to the actual decision makers who ultimately get to pass these policies.
Yeah, it sounds like a way of maybe leveraging up what impact you can have by working through local organizations as well as interfacing directly with local government. Sounds like a well-structured, well-thought-out idea. I'd like to dig in here in a little bit about what possibly you've done down around Tacoma here. But first of all, I would like to know a bit about who you are. How did you get involved in this project?
Yeah. Well, I've identified as an environmentalist since high school, but I've, you know, probably been an environmentalist my whole life in terms of just loving animals and loving the outdoors. And, you know, really, I just remember learning about climate change when Al Gore's movie came out. That was the first time that I really started to understand that there was a global crisis. And I was a kid then, you know, so I really grew up with this idea that things were, you know, in peril and that there was a big problem on our hands. But I didn't really internalize it or process it until I was in high school and took environmental science. And it was the first time that I took a class where I was like, oh, this is really important. You know, this is what we need to be working on. And I like was clearly the most engaged in my class, you know? And so it stood out to me as maybe being where my passion really was. And so I studied environmental policy in college, and then got into organizing after I graduated. And then I started this job at Stand just a year ago. And so I was just lucky enough, you know, I applied and found it and was fortunate enough to get hired to be in this position.
Yeah. So it sounds a little bit like Joseph Campbell said, you know, the best career is one where you follow your bliss. And it sounds like that's pretty much what you did. I'm just curious, you mentioned high school, and high school can be really a inflection point for a lot of people. Is there a teacher or teachers that you would happen to have a particular memory of who influenced you in your interest in the environment?
Yeah, well, I mean, my AP environmental science teacher, Mr. Espy, he taught that class, and like I said, that's really where I realized that maybe this is where my passion really was. And that was really the only class that I took in high school that was about environmental issues. So that's really the one that stood out to me. And then in college, you know, I took as many environmental classes as I could, really. And so I had, you know, a whole slew of wonderful mentors and professors in college who really helped me, you know, figure out what I really cared about and to deepen my understanding of these problems from a much more like holistic and comprehensive lens than was taught to me in high school through, you know, a primarily environmental science lens.
Yeah.
So I'm just really grateful for all of the educators who I've had who have brought different issues into my framework.
Yeah. So where was high school and where was college?
Oh, good questions. Also, is the audio and video okay? Because it's a little bit lagged on my end, and I want to make sure that there's not a problem happening.
No, I probably should. So we can edit this part out with no problem at all. So I probably should have filled in some blanks for you. So the way Zencastr works is that it records to our individual hard drives. So what we're watching and listening to is going over the internet. It's not the actual recording that we'll be using. So you're good.
So my version is good and your version is good. Okay.
Right.
Okay, sorry. Okay. I can go back
to that. I was my bad for not mentioning that up front because it can be disconcerting to see that it's not looking that great, but it is. It will be.
Oh no, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, your video was good.
Yep. So where were we? I forgot. Go ahead.
So I grew up in Los Angeles, California. And so I went to high school there. And I really, you know, I attribute my environmental ethic to getting to grow up on a coast and getting to spend so much time at the ocean and at the beach. And my like true number one love has always been the ocean and marine life. And I definitely, you know, connect that to the fact that my childhood was spent in Los Angeles. But then for college, I went into the middle of the country, went to the heart of the country, and I went to school in St. Louis, Missouri. So I got to have a very different experience and, you know, had the chance to learn about climate through a different perspective in terms of, you know, being in a different, you know, physical environment and relating to nature in a very different way.
Yeah. Awesome. So let's see if we can bring it down to Tacoma here a little bit. Give me some background on what you guys have been up to, if anything, down here in Tacoma, like the tide flats, mm-hmm. the LNG, petroleum storage, climate emergencies, all that stuff.
Yeah. So I, as you just listed, there's so much happening in Tacoma. And the bad thing is that Tacoma has consistently been threatened by fossil fuels, right? Like so many projects, all of these different problems. But the good thing is that there's so much community organizing also happening in Tacoma, and a lot of really wonderful individuals and groups and members of the Puyallup tribe who are dedicating themselves to fending off these threats and keeping Tacoma safe. So, I certainly don't want to take any credit for the work that's happening in Tacoma. And more than anything, my role with STAND and with Safe Cities is to support the work of folks in the community. So Citizens for a Healthy Bay is a local group in Tacoma, and they're our safe partner in Tacoma. So the work that they do is all about, you know, the sub-area planning and fighting off the LNG project and securing non-interim regulations. And we do what we can to support the work that they're doing and, you know, amplify their actions and get folks involved in their community organizing so that they can continue to build more power and do all of the awesome work that they're doing. We're also litigants in the case against PSE. So we're supporting in that way as well. You know, we sign on to letters, we send in comment to council, and really we just, you know, try to do everything that we can to support the work and provide, you know, solidarity to the organizing that's happening in Tacoma.
Yeah, certainly Citizens for a Healthy Bay is one of the organizations that does a lot down here and that we really love. So could you just briefly say where you see us on the whole LNG project? I mean, is there still hope that that won't become a reality?
I think that there's always hope. Just in general. But yeah, there's a court date that's coming up to review the greenhouse gas emissions as evaluated in their, you know, supplemental environmental impact statement. And the experts down there show that PSE is really, you know, severely undercounting their emissions in these environmental assessments. So we're looking forward to proving that they're doing this, you know, that they're essentially lying about their emissions. And we're really hoping that as we, you know, continue to push for building electrification, for example, and getting gas out of buildings, that we can really make the case that building a new LNG facility just doesn't make sense economically, as well as for all of the other reasons, you know, culturally, socially, environmentally, that it is a terrible idea for them to turn on this LNG facility, which should have never been built in the first place.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm wondering about is, well, first of all, I mean, far from expert on the whole LNG thing. That's part of the reason why I'm asking you these questions. So essentially, the gas that they're going to liquefy is fracked gas. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, and all of the environmental impact statements or other regulatory stuff, is the leakage and all of those things that happen both in transport and in extraction and so on, is that being considered as a part of the impact of that facility?
Yeah, so this is part of the problem, right? Is that it's really easy for PSE to say, you know, this is one of the ways that they are able to undercount their emissions because they can, you know, really omit all of these different pieces of the process. And, you know, as you just stated, there are so many points in the chain between fracking to actually burning gas, you know, in your building where methane is leaked in the process. And it's really easy for companies and fossil fuel companies and for utilities like PSE to just say, oh no, like it's an entirely clean process with almost no leakage. And it really allows them to make an argument that doesn't fully represent the full picture and doesn't actually tell the story of how terrible fracked gas is for our climate. The lifetime emissions.
One of the things I'm picking up from.
Critical.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, yeah, that's so important. So one of the things that I believe is true on all of these environmental things is that citizens, ordinary people who are concerned, they really need to do their homework, because the corporations put out these slick brochures, you know, they're two-sided, you know, they're slick, they're shorthand, they make everything look wonderful, and they've got a bunch of money, and they don't mind spending it, and they take the long view of things. And so I really think that we as ordinary citizens, we have to take it on ourselves to dig in and find out what's really true. Talk to people who may be less biased than the corporations that are trying to do it. So that's a part of what I picked up from what you're talking about the complexities of just methane leakage, for instance. So mm-hmm. and corporations do seem to be masterful at kind of disguising, concealing, spinning, so on and so forth. So anyway, I'm on my soapbox. I'll quit. So there's another project being proposed here in the Tide Flats, Seaport Fossil Fuel Storage. Are you guys looking at that at all?
Yeah. So it doesn't fall so much into our Safe Cities work, but it is an important piece of what's, you know, going on down in Tacoma. So I try to support that. Again, I try to support that organizing as much as I can by submitting comment and talking to folks about Seaport Sound. But yeah, I mean, they're trying to grow their storage capacity by 14%, which is just ridiculous. In this moment where we completely understand how dire the climate crisis is, and the fact that we have less than a decade to draw down our emissions significantly, the idea that any company is trying to expand storage capacity or extract more fossil fuels just needs to be out of the question at this point. And so we absolutely support, defeating this project, and supporting all the organizers who are saying no to the Seaport Sound expansion project. But again, as we're trying to get permanent protections in place and support building electrification, we hope that, companies will eventually soon, hopefully, stop even trying to propose facilities like this or expansions to facilities like this one.
Yeah, we can hope. And I just want to, I think you did a little misspeak early on there. You said that they had were increasing storage by 14%. They're actually increasing storage, or proposing to increasing by a factor of 14. So it's a massive increase in storage. Yeah.
Wow.
12 Thank or 14 you. Times, something like that. And of
wow.
course, there's an aspect of corporate speak, the way they're putting that forward too, because they're proposing an upgrade of the facility, and they kind of mm-hmm. hide in the background. Well, it's going to be many times bigger than it is right now. So, mm-hmm. with you 100% is that you know, we don't want to be building long-term fossil fuel facilities. I mean, the corporations that build them, they'll fight hammer and tong to use them for their useful life. And of course, they have their resources to do that. So better to not have them in the first place.
Yep.
Okay. So let's see.
And yeah, thank you for that correction.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of hidden away. It really is, because when I was first looking at the project, I'm saying, well, you know, this company, they're going to improve drainage and safety and upgrade tanks and stuff like that. And then down in the fine print somewhere, I find out that the capacity of this new upgraded facility is going to be 12 or 14 times larger than what they've got there. So it's huge. So one of the things that, and I think really we're kind of talking about the tide flats because that's where a lot of the action is, quote unquote. One of the things that I see, I think most people see, is that disadvantaged communities, poor communities, people, communities that are often people of color because of financial considerations, they really bear the brunt of the damage that we're doing with fossil fuels to our environment. So could you speak a little bit of some of your thoughts about that?
Yeah. And I really appreciate the question because we historically have not talked about it nearly enough. And it's way past time for us to be, you know, obsessing over this point because it's really, really, really important. Fossil fuels have always threatened poor and communities of color more than white communities and affluent communities. And that is not just a coincidence. And that is not because, you know, people are poor and people are, you know, not white. It's because fossil fuel companies know that they can get away with it, and know that they can put projects that are polluting communities around them in communities who, you know, historically have less political power in our country. And it's racist. It's totally founded on environmental racism and white supremacy that fossil fuel projects are, you know, on, for example, tribal land, like the Puyallup tribe's land. Right. And it's in Black communities. And it's not just that it's adjacent to them, you know, like, I said, I'm from LA, and there's the Inglewood oil field is the largest urban oil field in the country. And if you drive past it, you're looking at houses and schools with literally rigs right behind them. You know, like it, yeah. there are, it's not even a buffer between where children are playing and learning and where we are extracting oil from the earth. And that is intentional. It is there on purpose. And the fossil fuel industry has a lot of racism embedded into its practices and into their business models. And it's one of the most important reasons why it is absolutely urgent that we stop expanding fossil fuels, because we're seeing really terrible long-term impacts to all of these communities who are on the front line and fence lines of fossil fuel projects. And I mean, we're seeing this with all the pipelines. Pipelines time and time again are being proposed through native land. And we're seeing this with, you know, things like backyard drilling, which is right up against, you know, Black and brown neighborhoods.
Yeah, so it is racist, and it's just ugly too. Of course, there are costs of fossil fuel pollution that are not borne by the producers of the pollution. They're borne by the communities that are around them. And so in a very ugly sense, the poorer communities are absorbing those costs and saving the more affluent communities to have to deal with them. So in a very real sense, the poor folks are subsidizing the better off folks. And I mean, it just doesn't get any more unfair or unjust than that.
I went to college in St. Louis. So I was there for 4 years. And for folks who are familiar with St. Louis, the segregation between the Black community and the white community is really, really tangible and really strong. And it's really terrible. But you know, I really in college learned about environmental racism and environmental injustice. And one of the things that we always pointed to was the incredibly high rates of childhood asthma experienced amongst the Black population in St. Louis. And when we talk about childhood asthma, we're not just talking about kids needing inhalers. You know, we're talking about a need for kids to see doctors regularly, to go to the ER, to miss school for doctor's visits or because they're not able to breathe on a day with really bad air quality. And there are really tangible long-term impacts to kids who are growing up in communities with pollution. It is not just, oh, the air is gross looking, or, you know, oh, they might have asthma and they might not, and, you know, things are fine for the air to be dirty. These are really long-term impacts that accumulate over time and have a really significant weight on a community when they're, you know, faced with terrible air quality. And it's completely, I mean, unfair is an understatement, but yeah, it's really multifaceted.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking about what's it like to be a kid suffering from asthma. And I, you know, none of us performs at our best when we're not feeling well. And, you know, asthma is sort of just there all the time. And another thing that I thought about, I mean, I think it's easy to kind of say in a way, well, you know, asthma, yeah, it's too bad, but it's not that big a deal. It is a big deal. And one of the things that I remember from my childhood was that there was a kid in my class that had asthma, and he was very self-conscious about it. I mean, it affected his self-esteem that he was like that, and the other kids thought he was different. So, you know, those kinds of experiences a child can go on and on too. So when we do unjust or unfair things to other people, the ramifications of that are a lot more profound than they appear to be just with a casual look and say, it's just asthma. So exactly. We're getting close to the end here. So anything else about what you guys are doing, especially, of course, we're interested in Tacoma, but just in general about what you're doing that people should know about before we finish up here?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I have a few different things.
Okay,
so
go.
I'll start by saying that we're one of the areas that we're really excited about and focused on right now, and that's really related actually to childhood asthma, is building electrification. So for folks who maybe aren't familiar with that term, it's all about, you know, getting gas out of our buildings. So you might right now be in a building that is heated by a gas furnace. You might be cooking over a gas stove. All of that is, you know, methane fracked gas. And we need to electrify our buildings, which means stopping hooking them up to gas hookups and having all electric appliances instead. And this is a really exciting, you know, new movement that is starting to gain more traction finally. And Tacoma is right now in the process of starting to consider a resolution which would commit them to building electrification. So that is an exciting development and is a way that Tacoma is taking the lead on this in Washington. So we're really excited to get support from folks down in Tacoma on that. And we're hoping that that will come up for a vote probably April 20th. So that's something for folks to have their eye on. I also wanted to highlight a couple of other things that other groups are working on. So on Monday, Sunrise Tacoma is hosting a Green New Deal listening session, and that's going to be on Monday evening. And I'm happy I'll share the link with you for folks if they want to sign up. But if you don't already follow the Sunrise Hub, you can follow them on Twitter at Sunrise Tacoma or on Instagram, which is at Sunrise_Tacoma. And all of their event information can be found on their social media accounts. And then there's also a sub-area listening session on transportation, and that's this Saturday at noon. So that's in a couple of days. I don't know if this will be out by then, but I have a link to information about that as well. And then one more thing, which is that next Thursday at noon, my friends at 350 Seattle are hosting an event called PSE on Trial in the Court of Public Opinion. So it's a mock trial where we're going to outline all of the reasons why the Tacoma LNG project is a terrible idea and why PSE should be, you know, barred from opening up this plant. So that will be really fun and a really wonderful opportunity for us to highlight all of those problems and, you know, rally the community in support of ending that project. So I have a sign up for that as well. So lots of good things in Tacoma.
So it sounds like, really a lot of good things. And it sounds like great opportunities for folks to raise their voice. One of the things that I say is the least effective voice is the one that's not raised. And so, and you know, it's easy. I think the real barrier to raising our voices is just doing it the first couple, three times or something like that. And then you find out it's so easy. That's part of it. The other part of it is I find that almost universally, people are really grateful to hear my voice whether it's a city council, county council, my state legislator, federal representative. I think that it's easy to think, well, I'm just one person and I'm not really expert in this area and they're busy and so on. Those are not good reasons to not reach out. So we will definitely publicize those. Now, some of those will be. Our show is going to be running all of next week. So some of the stuff will be timely, some not quite so much. But one of the things that's true, I think, is that even if an event has already occurred, you go to the link and you can find out more about what's going on and so on. So good stuff. I wanted to ask you you mentioned the home electrification effort that's going on down here in Tacoma. Is that a Tacoma City Council project?
Hopefully the Seattle City Council will be reviewing and then voting on that resolution, which again, it's a resolution, non-binding, isn't the strongest possible policy that we would want, but it's a really good first step. And we hope that they'll be considering that and voting on it on April 20th. So we want to send in as many comment letters as possible and then have folks give public comment to City Council. So I'll also share with you an action that we have set up on our website so that folks can really easily send an email to all the members of City Council and, you know, show them support for passing this resolution.
Yep, sounds great. So I think that we are just about wrapped up here. I want to thank you so much for the work that you and your organization do, and also really grateful to you to take the time to share your passion for making a better future in our environment all the way around. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to come talk to you. And I just really, I appreciate that you have this show and are giving a platform for folks who are working on climate because we need to be talking about it as much as possible. So thank you for inviting me. It's been really lovely to get to be here.
It has been lovely. Thanks so much. So there you have it. I really enjoyed our conversation with Ingrid today. Admire her passion, her skill, her knowledge, and her determination to make this world a better place as we live in it now and as we pass it on to future generations. One of the takeaways for me is, there's lots going on here in Tacoma about fossil fuels and about climate in general. Sometimes it's easy to think about, well, we're just one medium-sized city in a great big world, but there is lots going on here. There's lots that we can pay attention to. There's lots that we can influence. And so let's do that. Ingrid is going to be providing with a number of links that you can speak out at, that you can become better informed at. Those will be in our show notes. That's available at ccltacoma.org. The CCL part's for Citizens Climate Lobby. I am an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a great outfit. Local chapter, very active. Check it out. You might find something of value there. I would love to hear from you now or any other time. John, J-O-H-N, at cctacoma.org. Okay, that's it for today. Here's me reminding you once again, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.